Welcome to Skeptica, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on today's show, I'm joined again by Gordon White to talk about his new book, Pieces of Eight. Wait a minute, I'm not actually joined by Gordon White. I mean, he's not right here right now. I'm not talking to him. But I guess through the magic of podcasting, I am kind of talking to Gordon. Let me explain. This book of Gordon's, which is the third that he's written in 2016, which is kind of an amazing feat, it is a fantastic compilation of essays. And a great bargain, I would add, at $4.44 on Amazon. Can't beat that. Kind of a strange pricing, but we'll have to ask Gordon about that. And we will ask him on the next episode of Skeptico. But what I wanted to do, because as I got into this material, it took me in so many different directions in so many ways, and I realized that I couldn't properly do an interview with Gordon without fleshing out some long questions and talking a ton of time explaining where I'm coming from and past shows and past ideas and how all those fit into these questions I have about Gordon's exploration of chaos magic. So what I thought I'd do today is tee up some of these questions that have been gnawing at me and have been popping up in the most recent episodes of Skeptico and see if I can dig a little bit deeper. So to give you an example of what I mean, let me play for you a clip from an interview that the oh-so-excellent McGill Connor did on his show, Aeon Byte Gnostic Radio, where he interviewed Gordon about this book, Pieces of Eight. Give a listen to this.
Materialism has been repeatedly falsified since it emerged as this kind of hobby worldview of Victorian scientists that suggested that the only things that exist are matter, there's just atoms, and everything kind of runs off this. Never mind the fact that it can't even, in principle, on a blackboard demonstrate how consciousness exists as a result of this as an emergent property or anything else. So it's been repeatedly falsified. Physics falsified it with the rise of quantum theory in the 30s. It was dismissed as, well, this clearly doesn't work, by about the 70s in philosophy departments. And really, the only people who stick to it are government-paid shills who've come out of a career in the defense industry to wear a bow tie and play a scientist on television, and newspaper journalists who are too stupid to kind of step outside this hologram. Now, the trouble is, as the majority of the world is kind of getting their head around the idea, like Richard Dawkins is not correct about anything, let alone materialism, they're trying to stay in the game by saying, okay, fine, so we've failed with the idea of telling you that consciousness is an illusion. Let's consider it an inherent property of matter. And that's what panpsychism is. So it's not saying it's the world is made of mind. It's saying that an atom or a molecule has a fragment of consciousness, and if you Lego block them together, you will get a fully blown consciousness. Now, this also fails because you have differing levels of consciousness in beings that have kind of less complex minds, especially if people have spirit experience. You're dealing with a consciousness there that has no matter. So how is that? How does the Lego block system work? It's essentially a way to try and keep the materialist ruse running.
Great stuff. My only regret, Gordon, is where were you when I started Skeptico? You could have saved 5 years off of my life. And the twist that Gordon has added to it that we've explored, but I don't think ever made quite as explicit as Gordon does, is this dual path that's being followed here, where science is playing this game like, oh no, materialism is the answer. It could never be anything else. Meanwhile, there's a group in the know, be they Stargate, MK Ultra, or whoever it is, who are off merrily proceeding along, trying to develop this knowledge just as rapidly as they can and deploy it in military or control situations. That seems to be an undeniable reality. And as I've said during the last few episodes, is the only way we can truly understand what's going on. So it might be interesting to get Gordon to comment on that. Another thing that Gordon does very nicely in the book Pieces of Eight and in his work in general is to easily and readily shift his focus from our current time frame to the ancient past. And if you remember the recent interview that Gordon did with Dr. John Brandenburg that was posted on Skeptico, sometimes that ancient past goes back millions and millions of years. But one of the topics I hope to raise in my conversation with Gordon is a reflection on the history of Christianity, since I think it looms so large on a lot of these issues we talk about when spirituality and esoteric thinking begins to intersect with our material world. So in an effort to tee that up, I prepared a little piece that I wanted to share with Gordon and share with you about some of what we've investigated here on Skeptico and I've found out about that early Christian period. Let me play this for you, and then I want to tee up some questions afterwards. There's a famous scene in the Bible. Well, it's the Bible, so what isn't famous in the Bible? But there's this scene where Jesus is looking over Jerusalem and he's with his disciples and he says, hey man, all this stuff is going to fall. Jerusalem is just going to be leveled to the ground. And the really interesting thing about this prophecy and a really important touch point in my kind of skeptico thing is that there seems to be a lot of evidence to suggest that that prophecy isn't really exactly a prophecy. So we have to get into some biblical scholarship details here, but I think it's worth the trip because what we're talking about here primarily is the book of Mark. That's where you get this kind of prophecy scene. And the problem with it is best explained by a former guest on Skeptico, Joseph Atwell. And what Atwell pointed out in his book, Caesar's Messiah, let me digress a minute here and say this is a book that has been widely criticized by a lot of different people. I know because I've talked to many of them on Skeptico. As an example, you may remember episode 290 when I talked to biblical scholar Joel Watts, who had written just scathing critique of Atwell's work. Well, if you go back and listen to episode 290, one of the things that's amazing about this is after all this thrashing around and criticizing, when you really push him, he comes to the same conclusion that Atwell does. And I found a similar pattern when I went jumped over and talked to the atheists. People like mythicist Dr. Robert Price and Dr. Richard Carrier. But the point is that this book, Caesar's Messiah, is a book that's been attacked on a number of fronts, but I think that those attacks miss the real point. And the point is back to the fact that what Atwell did was a literary analysis of Book of Mark on one hand, and on the other hand, a very ancient historical book by Josephus, Flavius Josephus, by the way, which maybe we'll get to in a minute. And that book was titled War of the Jews. So to start stitching together some of these patches of cloth, you have to first look at who was this guy Josephus? Who became Flavius Josephus? Flavius Josephus means he was accepted into the Roman Caesar Flavian family. So that's where he winds up. He winds up being a Flavian. He winds up being the historian for the Roman Caesar. And I must digress again, because I know a lot of you are like me, and you've heard this name Josephus before, but you just don't really know where you've heard it. And where you've heard it is from Christians primarily, Christian apologists, people who are promoting the idea that Jesus was a historical figure and we have proof. And the proof they haul out is Josephus. They say, hey, look, even this Roman historian Josephus admitted that Jesus was real, and then they'll pull out this one paragraph among thousands and thousands of pages that Josephus wrote where he says, oh yeah, and there was this guy Jesus, and he really did exist, and he caused quite a stir until we kind of put him down kind of thing. Well, to further carry on with that digression, all the evidence suggests that that wasn't originally written by Josephus, but was kind of stuck in there after the fact by some Christian writers who wanted to use the fact that we did have this history of Josephus to kind of stick Jesus in the story. And the reason I say that is because if you look at the larger body of what Josephus has written about, all of it would kind of be overthrown by this one paragraph. So a guy wouldn't write one paragraph that completely contradicts everything else he's saying. But that is a digression, but it's maybe a useful digression to understand why you've heard Josephus. But the larger question to ask is why you don't really know who Josephus is. Because who Josephus is this Jewish general who lives in Galilee, right? So this little kind of port town, out of the way place. And one of the little tidbits about Josephus that's interesting is that he's kind of a Romophile, if you will. I don't know if that's the right term, but he's been to Rome, which the Romans did a really good job of bringing in these high-ranking officials on lands that they controlled and bringing them into Rome and kind of showing them the big city and give them a little taste like they did. And they did that with Josephus, and Josephus loved it. He thought Rome was great. But then he returns to Galilee, and he's just kind of doing his thing. Well, meanwhile, the problems with Judea and the problems that the Romans had in ruling Judea finally reached this kind of boiling point. So now it's like 60 to 70 AD is the time period, and the Romans finally decide, okay, we got to go take care of this thing in Judea. So now this part is only speculation on my part, but I imagine what they do is they kind of go through their little book there and they say, hey, who do we know in Judea that might be on our side? And they come up with this guy, Josephus. Now, that's my speculation, but what is factual, known, historical record that we have from Josephus himself is that the Romans get there, they land in Galilee, they take it over, and as Josephus tells it, he's part of the rebellion. He's fighting the Romans with every breath that he has, and he has this band of guys, and they finally get cornered in this cave, and they get together and they say, okay, there's only one thing to do. We're going to lose. We're going to die. We're going to commit suicide. So they go about committing suicide, and then wouldn't you know, after his men commit suicide, Josephus, again, a Jewish general fighting the Romans, has this amazing epiphany. And he sees that the Romans aren't really the bad guys, but they're the good guys. They are the ones who the Jewish people have always prophesied. They are the ones who have come to restore and to redeem the Jewish people. And again, folks, this is history. This isn't controversial. This is what Josephus writes, and we accept everything that he writes as being the best history of the time. And his life, as it lives out, he is a living example of this. Now, a lot of Jewish people consider him a complete traitor for doing this, but yet this is who he is, what he believes. So at this point in our story, Josephus is turned, if you will. He becomes a Roman. He walks out of the cave and he says, hey, man, you know what? I see it now. I see more clearly what you guys have been saying. You guys are on the right. Let me help you. And he does. He helps march them right into Jerusalem, where they go about destroying Jerusalem, laying waste to the temple, and doing all that stuff that you read about in the Gospel of Mark. But again, the reason you read about it in the Gospel of Mark is because the Gospel of Mark is a blow-by-blow retelling of Josephus' War of the Jews. So obviously, whoever wrote Mark was writing from Josephus. That's the point of this whole thing. Or maybe it would be better said to say that's the starting point of this whole thing. Because now with that background, we're able to ask all the really interesting next level skeptical questions. And that's what I hope to do next. Okay, so I promised a bunch of jumping off points from that. So let's get started. Number one jumping off point. If you're a Christian that is a believer in the Bible, then you better just bury your head in the sand, right? Because that just blows that away. Here we have the book of Mark being written by a guy who's using this other document and claiming that it's Jesus saying that. So it's kind of game over for traditional Christian interpretation of the Bible. Doesn't say anything to your personal Christian spirituality, but in terms of Bible, out the window. Of course, the other jumping off point is for the atheists and people like mythicist Richard Carrier, who I referenced in the show. And these people, of course, because they're atheists, take it the completely other way. They say, okay, see what we mean? There never was any Jesus because we know there's nothing out there. There's no other extended consciousness realm. There's nothing like a spirit. There's nothing like a spirit world. There's nothing like spirit influence. None of that stuff can happen. And here's further confirmation of it. Look at, they made up all this stuff. Now,
What's interesting about that is they're ignoring the fact that that's not what Josephus is saying. Josephus isn't saying, unless you're completely cynical and think he's making all that up. Josephus is completely enmeshed in a spiritual world. He completely believes that there is this other realm. He just believes that the Roman Caesar Titus is the new Messiah, which we should add, the Romans are not atheists either, right? I mean, they're again completely enmeshed in the spiritual world, reading the entails of goats in order to decide whether to go into battle and seeking the favor of all their various gods. I mean, that is Roman spiritual life. But the other jumping off point for this, which is really interesting and relates more to Gordon's world, comes when you talk to folks like Dr. Jane Kent, who I just spoke with, and when I asked her, what about all this near-death experience research? In particular, what about the research of Dr. Jeffrey Long that says, hey, these people are encountering God during their NDEs, remember that?
Okay. In the book, God in the Afterlife, you asked, during your experience, did you encounter any specific information or awareness that God or a supreme being either does or does not exist?
I was amazed the unbelievable shift from how they would have responded to their thoughts about reality of God at the time they had their near-death experience to later, at the time they were sharing their near-death experience, an average of 20 years later. Virtually everybody that had a near-death experience and encountered God shifted to believing that God absolutely is real.
Well, what happens when you turn that to Dr. Jane Kent, who practices Wicca, is a shaman, who is actively seeking to interact with spirits and be guided and directed by spiritual forces? What does she do? She takes this same information that we're talking about here and says, no, it's already been proven. Jesus didn't exist historically. So therefore, there can be no Jesus in that spiritual realm.
Well, I'd say, you know, people who see Jesus, in inverted commas, standing at the end of the tunnel, you know, in light, are actually experiencing an encounter with their own soul, not Jesus, because Jesus, in my view, doesn't actually exist.
It seems to be kind of borrowing from the Richard Carrier atheist mythicist thing and says, oh, we just proved that Jesus doesn't exist, therefore we can't have any spirituality. And yet she's blending it with her own spirituality, which is completely interactive with that spiritual realm. A strange brew. But again, Christianity seems to cloud everyone's mind, and that's why I want to dig into this so far. It's the shadow that's always looming and clouding our view of things. Which leads me to the next jumping off point, and this is right in Gordon's wheelhouse. And that's the people in the magic occult world that seem to be stuck in the first jumping off point, that is, the Christian biblical understanding of history. So you hear things like,
I want none of your faint
hope. What you hear in the background.
This praise to hell with Christianity, rationalism, Buddhism. I want blasphemy, murder, rape, revolution.
A reading from Aleister Crowley, who for my money seems to get way, way too much attention and credit for someone who just had a kind of disaster of a life that was kind of resurrected after he died and mythicized into some kind of great accomplishment that I just don't see in looking at his history. But I digress, because the point is, why does Aleister Crowley want to poke the eyes out of Jesus on the cross? Why do occult practitioners want to say the Lord's Prayer three times backwards in a dark candlelit room if Josephus and the Romans were really the ones with their sticky fingers in the Bible story to begin with? Which leads to the next jumping off point, which is also in Gordon's wheelhouse and is probably to me the most interesting jumping off point, and that's the conspiratorial look at this. And it always irks me when people get on Joe Atwell, who did a lot of this work and wrote the book Caesar's Messiah. And let me explain that I think Atwell took the conspiratorial thing too far, because what Atwell said is, oh, so what this proves, what probably happened is the Romans wrote the Bible, cover to back every bit. They just sat down and they stitched this thing together in order to control the people from Judea. Well, that doesn't really hold up too much. But what I think we have to give Atwell credit for, and I think what Atwell is pointing towards, and what people often seem to overlook, is what he has shown is a conspiracy on the part of the Romans and Josephus to rewrite the Jewish spiritual tradition so that Titus was the Messiah. Now, I know I mentioned a minute ago that that's a cynical view of things, but we don't know the mind of the first century Jewish writer Josephus. We don't know the mind of the Roman ruling elite, but we certainly know a good psyop when we see it, and this is definitely one. And the important thing to note here, because we have a way of forgetting this when we look at history, is that this then became the history. This became the truth. This became the official sanctioned Roman history of what happened. And just because we know later that Constantine kind of changed the rules a little bit and said, hey, wait a minute, why don't we begin to adopt this thing called Christianity and we'll merge it into our Roman power control thing, which is a whole other story we won't get into. But my point is, we can't let that later history influence how we read that early history of what's happening here with Josephus and Titus. What's happening looks clearly to be a conspiracy. Okay, so I know I've stoked this fire with quite a bit of kindling, but I'm going to throw one more log on the pile. And before I do, let me qualify this. Obviously, I'm not a historian. Oftentimes, I feel like Marge Simpson, where she offers to give piano lessons to supplement the family income, and Lisa goes, but you don't know how to play. And she says, I thought I could stay one lesson ahead. In fact, you might say everything I know I've learned here on Skeptico. But one thing I do know is when you push people with hard questions, you have a chance at getting at answers that might bring you a little bit closer to the truth. And that's what happened with Joe Atwell and Joel Watts and many, many of these other biblical scholars and historians that I spoke to on the show. But I promised to throw another log on the fire, and it's a big one. Because in this section on Christianity, I know I've kind of jumbled together the idea of God and Jesus and Christ consciousness and kind of mished and mashed some ideas together, which inevitably happens unless you want to take an hour at every turn to explain what you're talking about. But I will risk that digression here and share with you another clip from an interview done by Miguel Connor, this time with biblical scholar Richard Smalley about his excellent book, How God Became God.
Well, to go back to this idea that every nation had a ruling God, Yahweh was the ruling God of Israel. Now, there's an interesting, this is in Deuteronomy 32:8, and although the English translations distort this, in fact, the Hebrew text distorts this, what it's really saying is that El apportioned the gods, or the angels, or the sons of God. Angels and sons of God were basically synonymous. The son of God meant angel in those days. El apportioned Yahweh to Israel. So Yahweh was the ruling angel of Israel. And this idea survived in the Kabbalah. And you will hear, you know, medieval Kabbalists, you know, write about, you know, each nation having its own ruling angel. Eventually, this angel became assimilated to the high god. Now, of course, this is not widely grasped even among scholars, because most scholars are still seeing, even the most authoritative, are to some extent seeing through a denominational lens. People who, you know, have been trained in divinity schools and seminaries that, you know, one way or another, things like the mainstream tradition of the Trinity, you know, kind of lingered around. So this is very difficult to see.
You mentioned, Richard, the exile, the Babylonian exile in the 5th century. And this seems to be a pivotal time in the biography of God and the Jewish people. You even write how Satan only appears in texts written during and after the exile. What exactly happened in the exile that changed the course of how they saw God?
Well, Satan is certainly one major, shall we say, innovation. One problem many people have with the Old Testament is that Yahweh is himself a somewhat ambivalent figure. He, you know, tempts David to conduct a census and then punishes him and the people for doing just that. If people is tempted by are people are tempted by evil spirits, these will often be described as evil spirit from the Lord, that is from Yahweh, came to them. Now, that was the way it was, because and it's natural, because if you really do believe in one God, you eventually are going to have to, you know, one grounded being, you're going to have to grant that everything comes from it, including both what we call good and what we call evil. As time went on, people began to have more trouble assimilating this. So a figure was introduced called Satan, which originally means the opponent, the adversary, the opposition. And he was, by consensus of most scholarship, probably brought in from Zoroastrianism, the Persian, ancient Persian dualistic religion, which posited, you know, kind of a war between the light and the darkness.
Now, Smoley's coming at us fast and hard with this information, and Miguel is deep into this as well, so he's keeping right up. But I had to listen to this a couple times to really absorb what we're hearing here. First off, we all had an inkling that this God of the Bible, the God of the Old Testament, had a bit of a strange lilt to his walk, but this really fleshes it out. What Smoley reveals is that when we really go back and look at the ancient history, we see this angel god Yahweh that is really cut down to size, just one of many who are apportioned to the different countries of the world. This one happens to be looking over the people of Judea. Then we find that he's married and that there's a Mrs. Yahweh. And we even find that if we look in the Bible we've had on the mantle above the fireplace for so many years, there she is. And I love the part where the common people are saying, hey, I ain't going to stop worshiping her. Things were really good when we put her on the altar. Why are we going to take her down? Is this the God of the Bible you heard about in Sunday school? I certainly didn't. And what about the bit on Satan? How revealing is that? So the Jews are marching along with their psychopathic Yahweh who's turning people into salt and, you know, doing all these horrible things and tempting and punishing and then being good and all this stuff. And then they see a dilemma and they go, you know, we really need to have a good God and then a bad God. So they break off all of Yahweh's bad characteristics and they pack it in this other character that they call Satan. Okay, all you occultists. Okay, all you Satanists. Okay, all you magical people. There's your Satan. He's Yahweh's alter ego. What are you going to do with that? So this is the history we're stuck with. I think there's a big divide between this history and spirituality. What does this history mean about the reality, and I say reality, of the spirit world and how it operates? Those are the deeper questions, but we can't get there unless we first come to grips with this history. And that's why I spent so much time going over all this obscure biblical stuff that I'm certainly not an expert on, but I'm so frustrated that the experts that I know don't seem to be putting it all together in a way that seems to fit into a coherent picture that I feel compelled to throw this in the campfire that I'm inviting Gordon to so we can warm our hands and tell a few tales. Which serves as a bit of a lead-in to the second set of questions I have for Gordon. Because the other thing I want to talk to Gordon about is the question of good versus evil. Now, over the last few episodes of Skeptico, you've heard me bring up this topic several times in several different ways. Here's a clip from Dr. Jane Kent.
Evil definitely exists. And to say that it doesn't is just ludicrous. Naive.
So the question, the big question for Gordon, is how does one navigate these forces of good and evil, of love and light and dark, or gray, as is so often the case? And if any of you are wondering how we got so far off the path from dogs that know when their owners are coming home and good old-fashioned parapsychology experiments, well, I have a little curveball to throw at Gordon on that one, too. You and Gordon
are going to have to wait until our live interview until we get to that one. So that about wraps this up. I hope you enjoyed this little prep session for my upcoming interview with Gordon White about his book Pieces of Eight. Be sure to check out the next episode of Skeptico when we'll publish that interview with Gordon. And be sure to check out skeptico.com, SKEPTIKO.com, for all the other shows as well. Thanks for all the emails, the notes of encouragement. I really appreciate it. And I really appreciate the guidance, help, and ideas that you continue to give me in terms of how to direct the show and how to make the show better. I can't stress enough that that is absolutely vital to my journey. As you can hear, maybe more clearly in this episode than in other ones, I am someone who has been changed by this material, and you are a big part of that change, so I thank you for that. So there's no need to tell you about the next show. You know what's coming there. But I have some other really good ones in the hopper as well. So do stick around for all of that. Take care. Bye for now.